Now, I was mentioning the proposed law that was brought forward yesterday by Senator Lynn Boylan in the Shannon. She is of Sinn Féin, and I'm going to bring you a bit more details on it in particular. So the legislation, it's to allow dogs seized by Gardaí to be rehomed quickly rather than stuck in kennels for, in quotes, months or years waiting for cases to be resolved. So Lynn Boylan submitted it. It's to amend the Animal Health and Welfare Act. Currently, dogs seized by Gardaí under the Act cannot leave the custody of a kennel until the relevant animal welfare case is brought to court. Now, the DSPCA, the Dublin Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, is often asked by Gardaí to take care of the seized pets, and they have assisted in drafting this new law. And the head of education and media with the DSPCA joins me now, Gillian Bird. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Very good.
I'm finding it difficult to get my words out there. DSPCA is what I'm trying to say.
That's it.
You have been involved in this act, so give our listeners a little bit more detail.
Yes, so one of the big problems is that any animal seized, and it's usually the guards or the likes of the DSPCA that would seize animals, the animals have to stay in the custody of the guards or the inspectors in our case as well, until the case has been brought to court. And that can take 18 months, 2 years to actually come to case. So the animals are left in kennels, and obviously in the DSPCA they're well cared for, they're walked, they're loved, but they're still living in a kennel environment. And in many, many cases, those animals can't even be put into foster care for that period of time. So you could end up with the guard seizing a litter of puppies in the boot of a car down at the port. And those puppies could be 7, 8 weeks old, and they cannot be rehomed until possibly they are over a year old.
Now, the bill does note that the legislation has certain lacunas that limit the ability of groups to protect animals and has, again, in quotes, strengthened the hands of those who smuggle and abuse animals. So the memorandum, this is the quote from it, says, when animals are seized under the Animal Health and Welfare Act, including puppies seized at the ports, the authorities do not have the power to rehome the animal. As a result, the animal must be housed in kennels while they wait for the offences to come to trial in court, as you're mentioning. Can take months or even years, and especially since the pandemic, the court system, I'm sure there has been a backlog there. We've heard about it, and I'm sure when it comes to these cases there's also been a backlog. And even though what yourselves at the DSPCA and other kennels etc. across the country do is amazing work, and they're there to care for the animals, the truth is it's no substitute, as it's been put, for a caring family home.
No, absolutely. I mean, when you look at a puppy, for example, and we do get a lot of puppies into us, you know, you end up with a puppy and it's the first few months of that puppy's life where it is being socialised, it's trained, it's living in a family home, it's learning how to be a dog living with humans. That's the important stages. And no matter what care you give an animal in a kennel environment, it cannot get the things it would get if it was living with its forever home. So we can't even put these into foster homes or temporary homes. And I know people have these images of kennels and all the rest of it, but I mean, yes, they are a place for the animal to sleep and the animal to spend time. But even still, taking an animal out for a walk, even if you're taking them out for a walk 10 times a day, it's still not the same as having a nice little basket curled up in the kitchen or in the living room, living with a family.
Yeah, I absolutely love dogs myself, so I find this really hard, because you have noted that long periods of time spent in the kennels, or obviously you're given so much love when you're in places like charities at the DSPCA, but it's still not the same, as you've noted. Some of the animals in the kennels, they can actually become institutionalised and develop behavioural issues. And then in the long run, they may act out one day. And unfortunately, in lots of cases, that animal may be deemed then vicious, an animal that needs to be put to sleep, put down, and can no longer, I guess, live in society.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, it's more down to here, and this is why it comes under the Animal Health and Welfare Act. This is about the long-term welfare of the animals, and not even the puppies. It could be an older dog. It could be a dog that was taken. And we always try and see if we can get a seizure. Or when the seizure is done, we always try to see if we can get the owners to actually surrender the animals to us so they legally become the property of the DSPCA so they can actually be rehomed. But your other issue is the fact that these are animals that, you know, really need to be in a proper environment. They need to be allowed to be dogs. And it's just not an ideal situation. So it would be fantastic if we can actually have the law changed. And the other issue is that a lot of people, you know, don't really think about. We could end up having an animal in our care for 18 months because we're looking after it for the guards for some case they have seized the animal. That case could end up going to court and the judge could turn around and rule that that animal has to go back to its owner. So even if it's a situation of the animal going back to the owner, that animal is still going to be institutionalised from being in a kennel for that length of time. So it's not even the new homes, but it's also the fact that sometimes these animals may end up going back to the original owners where they maybe should not have.
Figures from the guards show that 373 dogs were seized by Gardaí in the past 3 years. 59 in 2019, 236 in 2020 and 28 in 2021. The figure this year is fewer than 10. That's 2022. Obviously, we're in May at the moment, so 5 months in. If you look at the figure of 2020, Gillian, am I to assume the 236 has to do with many people, in some cases, purchasing dogs, some obviously adopting from charities like yourselves during the pandemic?
No, well, a lot of these cases would be animals seized in the port where people are legally smuggling them out. But you also have situations where the guards may be attending a totally different situation and they find animals that are not in suitable conditions in a home or on a property. So a lot of these animals will be seized under the Animal Health and Welfare Act by the guards because they're not in good condition or because in some cases there's no proof of ownership. As well, because they're not microchipped.
So the pandemic
would be another reason.
So the pandemic wouldn't have actually affected those numbers, really?
In fact, it probably would have lowered those numbers because less animals were actually being illegally exported out of the country through Dublin Port and through Wexford as well. So there would be probably less animals being seized for those reasons, yeah.
Okay, so the bill, they're also looking, or you included, obviously, coming up with this piece of legislation, looking to amend the Control of Dogs Act. That means introducing an obligation on dog owners to prove ownership by linking their pet microchip to the owner's dog license. Is that, I'm assuming that has a very low uptake at the moment, Gillian?
It does, absolutely. So the issue, there's a few little gaps in the legislation under the microchipping laws. There, it's under the Control of Dogs Act as well as the Animal Health and Welfare Act. And what can happen at the moment is that you can have your dog microchipped, but the chip is not registered to you, so you can then register it. But under law, you must have a dog license for your dog, but many people don't. And what can happen is you can walk into your post office, take out a dog license, pay your fee, put down the microchip number on that, and that can then technically make you the legal owner of that dog. So there needs to be proper authentication between the microchipping and between the dog licensing, and it would be wonderful to bring the whole thing into one thing where we don't have to go for the paper dog license, that the microchip would be the dog license.
Okay, I appreciate your time this afternoon. That is the Head of Education and Media with the DSPCA, Gillian Bird. Thank you on the proposed law being brought forward by Senator Lynn Boylan of Sinn Féin in the Seanad yesterday. But the DSPCA help to write this bill. Apologies, words escape me right now. Alongside Senator Boylan, it was submitted yesterday. So it's to amend the Animal Health and Welfare Act. Currently, dogs seized by a Gardaí under the Act cannot leave the custody of a kennel until the relevant animal welfare case is brought to court. And the DSPCA is often asked by Gardaí to care for seized pets and has assisted in drafting the new law. As I said there, Gillian Bird, thank you very much. So parents, I don't know if you're surprised by this, but 15-year-olds everywhere, according to a recent UK study, have been revealed to be the most difficult age to parent. Joining me to discuss this is journalist Jen Hogan and, of course, mother herself. Good afternoon, Jen.
Good afternoon, Kira.
Tell me, you do have children of your own. As I mentioned, you are a mother, so it means you have children. What are your kids' age range?
So I have a 15-year-old. I have to be so careful in saying this, but I have a 15-year-old, for prime example. My eldest is, I have a 20, 17, 15, 13, 11, 8 and 6-year-old. Wow. That's 7, isn't it? So yeah, loads.
Oh my God, I don't know how you do that. Wow, that is amazing. So obviously the big wide range of ages means that you've faced quite a few ages in terms of parenting. Would you agree with that 15-year-old age bracket in general? Now I know, you know, each child is different. You do have 7 and, you know, one 15-year-old could be the most amazing 15-year-old versus another being maybe the devil reincarnated. But
I think that's how lots of parents of 15-year-olds might describe them, particularly at the moment as we get close to the junior cert and we have a whole different stressor, and lots of 15-year-olds are doing the junior cert. I don't know, I think 12 to 15 is absolutely probably one of the most stressful parts of parenthood, and that's really hard to get your head around, particularly if you're at the other end of it or at the very beginning of it, and you've got sleep babies who aren't sleeping, and you're having to take half the house with you every time you just leave to buy a pint of milk, and all the stresses that go with early parenthood and even finding your feet. But everything's so much harder when you're sleep deprived. But when you get to 12 to 15, as is natural, they start to pull away from you. I mean, that's the whole idea. We're supposed to prepare them to live without us, and they're starting kind of to assert their independence, and then they've got all these hormones and all these peer pressures and societal pressures and even social media pressures all coming at them. And, you know, we were no different really ourselves. We thought we knew it all when we were that age. They think they know it all when they were that age. And it's generally around 15 is the age that they will do their first state exams as well. So it's that first real pressure too. Although you'll have lots of parents say they're feeling the pressure more than their 15-year-olds, and perhaps never more so than this year after the couple of years that we've had with COVID. So I do think there is something definitely in it. I imagine many parents of 15-year-olds are nodding along furiously. It is even all the different things that you are dreading, they start to come on scene, the battles about going out, alcohol becomes a real concern for a lot of parents at that stage, where, you know, parties, is it happening, are they drinking, are they not drinking? There's so many worries around that age. And then you have a 15-year-old who's perhaps withdrawing as well a little bit from having maybe the more open conversations that they might have had when you were the center of their universe back when they were 8 or 9, maybe, depending how early the preteen years kick in, and probably depending whether you have a boy or a girl, because definitely girls hit this kind of pull away, from my experience anyway, at a much younger age. I suppose that maturity coming into play. But I mean, as a parent of a 15-year-old and having had a couple of 15-year-olds and having the other ages in between, I don't see it as the worst age. I find the hardest when they've come out the other side and when they're actually either on the cusp of adulthood or are already adults, and you've got to butt out. Like, for all those years you've interfered, you've been the one who's kind of set the terms, done the negotiations.
It's harder to let go, really, is what you're saying.
It's really hard to let go. And it's really hard, you know, your instinct is to want to step in and save them from making the mistakes that you made, which we're doing kind of all through the teenagers. You're wanting to stop them making the mistakes you made, or stopping them from making what you can see is a clear error of judgment. But that's part of growing up, and that's part of being a teen, part of being a young adult too. And it's your job, not necessarily your job done, because you're always going to be their parent, always going to be their parent, but your role changes as they get older, and your role certainly changes when they're 18 and they're an adult. And I suppose that's a little bit more complicated by the fact that lots of 18-year-olds are still in school now with the transition year, and the fact that the vast majority of students do transition year. You're talking about having adults in school in sixth year, which is a totally strange one, because they're very much, you know, they have to follow the school rules. They still have their second set of state exams. They've got to act nearly childlike because they're still in school, but they're adults. They're going to be down the pub drinking and they've got to go to school.
But also at times I think, because society as a culture, we're living longer, you know, a 15-year-old in 1956 was a different 15-year-old to 2022. I was 15 13 years ago, and I have to say I was actually quite a good 15-year-old, like, honest to God, compared to my fellow peers. Now, I wasn't perfect, obviously, far from it. But people can have such different experiences. And you touched there on things like, I guess, one's emotional and mental development. A lot of people struggle with feelings when they're kind of around that 15-year-old age group. You know, the hormones, yes, obviously, but you're feeling maybe you've never felt before. Life has gotten a bit more complex. What advice would you have for parents who are facing into that at the moment? It's I guess it's it's good advice to say, just because, you know, a teenager is going through a tough time doesn't immediately mean, you know, get the red flags up. This is a panic situation.
Absolutely. And I think we have to actually cut this. We have to cut the current crop of teenagers actually more slack than ever before, because their teenagerhood or teenagerdom was actually completely frozen there when we had lockdowns and when we had school closures and we had all those different things. And they didn't get the chance to experience to have some of the experiences that they should have had. They didn't get to navigate some of the situations that they might have, friendships or other situations in school or outside of school, because they were very much cut off from their peers for quite a while. So they're now kind of 2 years older, but not necessarily 2 years wiser, because they still, you know, there were, it wasn't just about milestone occasions that they missed out on, but it was normal developmental social opportunities to mix and to deal with difficulties too. So they're at a very different situation. Some of them are very aware of being that bit older and perhaps not having had some of the experiences that they should have had. I think the definition, I think I said in my column, the definition of madness is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. And, you know, our own parents would have nagged us and had a go at us about not doing this and not doing that. And I was a bit like yourself, Ciara. I was a very, my parents got an easy ride with me as a 15-year-old because I think I was a very cautious 15-year-old. But you have to bear in mind that not everybody's the same. And not everybody's experience of life's the same. And just because we were 15 once, we might know some of the stuff, but the challenges are never truly the same. So it's about keeping those lines of communication open as much as you can. Having the whatever conversations you can, trying to find out from them bits of what's going on in their life, even just trying to get the measure that they're happy. And that's for me, the biggest thing is that they're happy. But also, like you said there, trying to get that balance right of not panicking completely, just because, you know, it's very normal for things to go up and down, but it is being aware that maybe if there is an issue that you can maybe try to have a conversation or try to support them about with it. It's a really difficult age. It's a stressful time, and it's a really difficult age. And the fact that they tend to kind of withdraw from the relationship that we once knew when they were younger is really hard to get our heads around. But it is also completely developmentally normal. That's what 15-year-olds are supposed to do. You know, they're supposed to be trying to be more independent, more grown up, but they're still only kids in adults' bodies. And that's what we need to remember in terms of cutting them slack. They are children in adults' bodies. And there is so much negativity around teens. They're absorbing this. They're not oblivious to this. I did point out that I think it's particularly relative when you're speaking about teenage boys, who have probably, I don't know if there's a more vilified group in society than teenage boys, we're automatically suspicious of them. But it's really difficult for teenage girls too, who also get a bad rap. It seems to be they're kind of that one age group that we're quite happy to accept sweeping generalizations about them, and to accept you know, the kind of Kevin and Perry sort of thing. Oh, you know what teens are like, you know. And
my brother was nicknamed Kevin when he was younger.
Yeah, I think that's just it. There's a lot of teenagers nicknamed Kevin. Yeah, but I mean, it is about, I suppose, accepting that everybody's having those different experiences.
Yeah.
And, you know, just trying to support them through it, trying to remember you're the adult. It's not always easy. It really isn't always easy, particularly, you know, if you're dealing with, it feels like you're dealing with a brick wall all the time, you know, because you might be getting something back, or you're dealing with a grumpy teen. But I suppose it's about having the conversation.
Well, I'm quoting you here.
Yeah.
You said from your article in the Irish Times, let's be honest, teenagers didn't earn a reputation of being pains in the ass for no reason. Direct quote from you, Jen Hogan.
It's true. I will stand by that. It absolutely is true. They are giant pains in the ass as well sometimes. But like,
you did it 7 times. You obviously like doing it. It's obviously a good job to have.
You come out the other side, I suppose. That's the only way I can see it. And there's huge advantages to having it. I think we don't maybe focus enough sometimes on the positivities and the things that they can be aware of and how in tune they can also be. I mean, the whole nature of teens, isn't it really, to be a little bit self-absorbed? But they're also, as well as being self-absorbed, in a completely total contradictory manner, I'm going to say this now, they're also very much aware of what other people are going through and the important things. They're the ones who are leading the way here on climate change. It's not the older folk here, but, you know, they're
always very empathetic and compassionate.
You know, and much more so perhaps because they have a wider understanding. Maybe social media has been positive in that regard, a wider understanding sometimes of what's going on in the world. But what you said there about the 15-year-old in the 50s, that is so true. And there is this
whole conversation with this new thing, you might have heard about it, emerging adulthood, where we're not actually proper adults until we're really 25. Now, that caused its own consternation when that kind of research was discussed. But the fact is that we aren't, because our brains continue to develop. It's not until we're 25 that we're proper adults. But it's also down to lack of experience. People are younger for longer because they're in maybe the education system longer, because they start school later, because they maybe go on and do a couple of college courses, or else maybe don't go into what they want to do directly and do something else first. So they're not perhaps in what we might term the real world until later in life. And it is experiences that makes us who we are. Well, that's what I reckon anyway. So I do think we have to bear all that in mind when we're ready to tear our hair out.
Well, Jen Hogan, journalist, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. Take care.
Pleasure, Ciara. Take care. Bye.
You may have heard this news yesterday. Drinks firms, they're getting free advertising from awnings given to pubs and restaurants. So says Sinn Féin's housing spokesperson, Ono Brin. He was telling an Oireachtas committee yesterday. So they're getting free alcohol advertisements by providing these partitions and awnings with the logos on them of their brand for the pubs and restaurants that are offering the outdoor dining. So he says that saying such alcohol advertising at businesses that serve outdoors was contrary to the spirit of the government policy and legislation in this area. And somebody who we've spoke with before on this issue is Eunan McKinney, who's the head of communications and advocacy with Alcohol Action Ireland. Good afternoon to you, Eunan.
Good afternoon to you, Ciara. Thanks for having me on.
I'm sure this is something that yourselves at Alcohol Action are backing.
Yeah, I think what the politician who made the observation is witnessing and seeing is just a proliferation of alcohol promotion, brand promotion material, which is very evident now, certainly when it comes to streetscapes and outdoor entertainment areas on these premises. And what the suggestion is that they're trying to circumvent essentially the law around the restrictions on advertising and promotion. And I think that, you know, we could certainly see that that was the case. I mean, so under the law, there is restrictions on where you can place alcohol advertisements and things like public transport and you know, outdoor advertisements that will be near schools and stuff like that. They're all are essentially prohibited. But exempt from that are licensed premises. So when the law was essentially debated and passed in the Oireachtas, it was intended that there wouldn't be a restriction placed on a public house, for example, that was next to a school or in a town, we'll say. So they didn't want to ensure, the lawmakers didn't want to restrict that business from advertising what type of a business it was. But now what you're witnessing is really the alcohol producers and the alcohol brands really take an opportunity to exploit that now by placing massive levels of promotion on brand awareness on these premises. So, I mean, typically you see that quite a lot now in the streets and towns in the streets of our towns across the country, where there are, you know, these awnings, or there are umbrellas, or there are all sorts of
promotions. Some of the barrels that are used as tables in the outdoor dining as well often have the logos published on them or printed on them. So Dara O'Brien was asked, is there something that can be done to ensure this doesn't happen, by Ono Brin? Obviously Dara O'Brien is the housing minister, and he did note that in some counties, he said more than just this, I'm just saying this for the purpose of this interview, in some counties local authorities provided the street furniture and also the awnings and also the partitions, so they're uniform and they look better, he said, frankly, as well. The government is proposing the continued waiver of the €125 fee that pubs and restaurants must pay for outdoor tables and chairs, which obviously is great for many of these who are still in the red post-pandemic. But I'm sure a lot of these pubs and restaurants will make the argument that it is cheaper to accept something like this from a drinks company. Obviously, the drinks company is getting the benefit of advertising, but especially post-pandemic.
Yeah, that's exactly what they are doing. And I mean, much of this did start at the time of the pandemic, when there was no indoor, when the licensed premises were largely closed, but you could drink outside. And so a whole set of first street furniture and outdoor furniture became necessary for the publicans to try and, in fairness, try to make a living and try to run a business. And of course, everyone's entitled to do that. But I think what we're seeing in the context of what is the point that was raised by Owen O'Brien is within the spirit of the law, I think there's an endeavour, not by the publicans, but by the producers and by the brands to try and circumvent what is the idea that you would limit. I mean, the purpose of the Act and the purpose of the measures in the Act was to reduce alcohol promotion. And indeed, you know, only yesterday we saw the WHO produce a very lengthy and very detailed report about just highlighting how insidious the practice of alcohol marketing is in terms of luring young people into a lifetime of drinking. And so this type of acceptability or the placement of alcohol promotion on our streets, in our communities, is now seen to be acceptable. And we would argue that that's not within the spirit of the law. And I think they know that that's not within the spirit of the law.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time this afternoon. That is Eunan McKinney, Head of Communications and Advocacy with Alcohol Action Ireland. The committee did also hear from Dara O'Brien saying that local spaces are now being used, this is, quote, more productively, end quote, since the pandemic should not be given, again, in quotes, back over to cars, end quote. I know lots of people still have their opinions on formats that have changed in counties or in towns throughout this county, especially Newbridge. People are still discussing, you know, the bike lane, but also the fact that many spaces have now been taken to expand the outdoor dining areas from cars. And there are many people who are annoyed by that. But the Labour Housing spokesperson, Rebecca Moynihan, at the committee also said that she welcomed the minister's comments and that the cities and towns of this country need to be made more livable, walkable and bikeable. That part is a quote from Rebecca Moynihan. So do let us know what you think about that. Do you feel as if the awnings and the partitions at the restaurants and pubs are branded too much? Have you noted it yourself? Because it was only when I read this article yesterday that I noted to myself, especially things like those barrels that they use as tables now. God, that's branded. It just kind of clicked with me. I'm obviously very slow. I'm not keeping up with these things as much as other people are, but let me know.